Over the last several years, we began to see VC money coming in, venture capital money, Wall Street money, has been interjected into the case acquisition process here for mass torts. That is a game changer. Lawyers, mass tort attorneys, are do very well, but they don't have the millions upon millions upon millions that Wall Street has. And if Wall Street starts lending out money to acquire cases to certain firms, it's all likelihood that those certain firms are going to get the vast majority of cases and make other firms disinterested in spending similar money to try to get less cases. Because once someone gets involved and starts buying up ad times, that ad time becomes more expensive or starts, you know, dominating Facebook or social media advertising. That does worry me.
Welcome to Trial Lawyer View, the podcast dedicated to the fierce yet compassionate lawyers who fight every day for justice in the courtroom. Our guests are top trial lawyers and their firms who share their stories and experiences, offering valuable insights into their journey, as well as expert guests who provide actionable strategies and practical tips for personal injury lawyers looking to optimize their operations, enhance client service, and drive growth in their practices. Trial Lawyer View is brought to you by Synergy. At Synergy, we aren't just a service provider. We are a strategic partner for personal injury law firms, seamlessly integrating with law firms to boost efficiency from day one. Outsourcing cumbersome administrative tasks like lien resolution and Medicare compliance to an expert partner like Synergy enables personal injury firms to focus on what they do best.
Welcome to another episode of Trial Lawyer View, where I'm joined by Michael Brady Lynch. Michael is a nationally recognized trial attorney and passionate advocate for victims of defective drugs, medical devices, and personal injuries. With over two decades of experience, Michael has built a reputation of one of the most dynamic and committed mass tort trial attorneys in the United States. As the founder of Michael Brady Lynch firm, he leads a national practice focused on complex mass tort litigation. His firm has been at the forefront of significant mass tort cases involving Ozempic, talc, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma caused by Roundup. Throughout his career, Michael's been deeply involved in nearly every major pharmaceutical and medical device mass tort in the country. As a result, he's been instrumental in advocating for large-scale societal change, fighting for the rights of victims, and holding powerful corporations accountable for their actions. Today, we focus on mass torts, including Ozempic, Roundup, talc, and the Texas two-step. Michael, welcome to Trial Lawyer View, and thank you for being with me today on the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Hey, Jason. Thanks so much for the invite. I've been looking forward to it.
You've been involved in some of the biggest mass tort cases in the United States over the past two decades. Can you talk about your journey into mass tort litigation and what drives you to fight for these victims every day?
Sure. Well, I'm an attorney for almost 30 years now, and I began my journey into mass torts back in 2001. That's how long I've been doing almost exclusively mass torts. I was a young PI attorney in New Jersey, strictly doing single event work, which, you know, what we call car accidents and other things. I was looking to make a change, and in 2001, in August, I was approached by an experienced mass tort attorney who had done some litigation involved factor five blood litigation. So I knew he knew his ropes. He was on the PSC of several litigations. And in August, a cholesterol drug called Bakol was withdrawn from the market. And unbeknownst to me, it was probably the best drug in the world for a young attorney to learn the ropes on a mass tort. And I'll tell you why. Cholesterol drugs were all the rage back then. Back in 2001, there were five cholesterol drugs on the market. You always heard the names Lipitor and Zocor, but there were three others. Bakol wanted to be the fifth drug. So the perception at that time in the world and in the community and in the patient population were that cholesterol drugs were very safe. Lo and behold, this drug comes out, Bakol, and almost instantly there's all these problems. Reports of people going to the hospital, reports of people dying, and they're dying of a condition known as rhabdomyolysis. Now, it turns out that all statins, that's what those cholesterol drugs are called, all of them cause rhabdomyolysis, but none of them do it in the to the magnitude in which Bakol did it, and it did it as soon as it got onto the market. So it was a great drug to start, it also was a great drug to start on because it had what we call a signature illness or signature injury, meaning it's not a case where we throw everything at the wall, causes heart attacks, causes this, causes that, causes one specific thing that you can easily get diagnosed at a hospital. So it makes it kind of more simplified to learn. It also was one that you had to know something was bad because it was taken off the market by the FDA. You also know it had to be bad because there's five other drugs in its class that don't do this to the magnitude it does. All those factors, if you were going to ease me into mass torts, that was the way to do it. And I got to meet a lot of great attorneys. I became quite well known for my work in Bay Hall. I spoke at conferences, and I was kind of one of the biggest experts in that case, all from just being a young attorney that never had any experience in mass torts. And what it did in terms of my drive to help out people is that it changed my perception of way drugs in the United States are approved, how they're marketed, what their safety profiles really are, and all the chicanery that goes into the approval process in terms of studies that are purposely given too many patients to make a difference. If they see some bad results, they just say it was underpowered. There's a lot of ghost writing on medical journals. You know, the pharmaceutical company, you find out, really are in bed with the regulators. And there's very little emphasis on any patient safety until their hand is forced. And that applies both to the government and to the pharmaceutical company. And just kind of like an offset, what you have sometimes is people say, well, you're an ambulance station, you're only in it for the money. This is not true. This is patient care on a wide scale. This is the drugs that you put in your body every single day, that your parents use, that your children use if they're sick. You really do feel good about helping such a large number of people doing mass torts. One-on-one single event cases, you're certainly doing a great job for folks. But mass torts, you could really make a difference on kind of a nationwide stance. And I've been doing it ever since.
Well, you're keeping these big corporations in check that have billions of dollars and don't really care sometimes about the repercussions of those drugs, bringing them to market when they can injure people. So, you know, your group of lawyers, and it's a, you know, fairly small group of lawyers that hold these corporations accountable in mass tort cases, is such an incredibly important thing. And you and I go way back. I remember when I met you when you were getting started, but now you've got this long list of drugs that you've worked on, but we still have these same cases. So now you've got Ozempic and some of these other drugs that are gaining significant attention for their weight loss benefits, but we're seeing an increase in the number of cases related to serious side effects. What are the main dangers with these new drugs that are sort of kind of on the forefront of the cases now? And how are you approaching the litigation of those claims?
Well, I've been doing Ozempic now for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. I spoke at some conferences where people really didn't even know what Ozempic was. It was even hard to explain to them that it wasn't a pill. It was a shot. And we're so used to getting pharmacy records and getting this. When I was trying to tell people about this and trying to explain it, it really was considered a wonder drug when I presented at conferences. They didn't see a lot of people taking these drugs, which as an attorney is something that kind of shies you away sometimes from pursuing a case. You don't want to spend advertising dollars and only get a few cases. But I did tell them, I said, this is going to change everything. You're beginning to see a lot of influencers talk about Ozempic. Sooner or later, you're going to see big top stars talk about their weight loss. You went to the Oscars. If you watch the Oscars, no one watches the Oscars, but some people do. And they always report on what the stars look like every year. What are they wearing? If you went and got what was happening with this Oscar, everyone talked about the incredible weight loss of all these Hollywood stars. And everyone's doing the wink, wink. It's probably Ozempic or one of the other drugs in that class. And no one's denying it. So what you began to see is this drug that was designed solely for diabetes. That's what it was used for. If you had type 2 diabetes, this affects the insulin production in your body. It's a great diabetes drug for those that are indicated for it. Then they found out, kind of like how they found out in Viagra, that there was a secondary effect that you decided to lose a lot of weight. Now, if you remember with Viagra was a drug that they thought was going to treat heart disease. it didn't do that very well. But so what happened was, is that when people would, who were on the clinical trials, the men, they say, man, you know, I'm feeling something down there, very strong. So what they did is they took a drug that they thought was going to be a heart disease drug and turned it into an erectile dysfunction drug just by what they saw when they were testing it. What happened in this case was, is that these individuals who were taking this class of drugs for diabetes began to report to their doctors, and even the doctors could see it on the scale, that they're losing a substantial amount of weight. What they began to do is aggressively market, you can't market off-label, but they began to aggressively market and try to get a change in indication that it can actually help you lose weight. Once that, it exploded all over the place. And what you began to see once a drug explodes everywhere, is you begin to see what really happens when it gets in a large-scale population, a non-diabetic population, because these are individuals using it for weight loss, not diabetes. The biggest condition that we began to see right off the bat was a condition known as gastroparesis. Gastroparesis is when there's a slowing of the emptying of the stomach into the intestines. It can basically seize up, and you can get some rather minor complications like nausea and vomiting. But you can get gastroparesis, which is essentially a surgical emergency. You're going to be admitted to the hospital, likely have surgery. It's a life-changing condition. You're never going to be on the drug again. Big scar, all that stuff. And people have died from it. I have several death cases, even in my small office. I don't have large-scale patient populations anymore as clients. But I, since I've been advertising early on, I've got upwards of 15 death cases that I'm pursuing. The other case we're beginning to see now, the other injury we're beginning to see is blindness, which is kind of crazy. But it all goes in hand. If you know how these drugs work, that's not, you know, diabetes and blindness goes hand in hand. But you're seeing an increase in blindness. So now my new patient profile, when I try to get clients, is have you had vision problems? And there is an MDL in this case. There are a large number of cases that are filed. And we're beginning to file blindness cases. You don't want to jump the gun because I think we have real good science on gastroparesis. But blindness is going to be the secondary injury profile. What's going to happen in this litigation is I truly think that this drug is going to continue to get more people to take it. It's just word of mouth. You've never had a drug, I think, that you can go to your local restaurant or bar or talk to your friends and they know what Ozempic is, because everyone knows someone who's on it and has lost a lot of weight. What no one is talking about is these side effects. And I think they're doing a great job of talking about the benefit and not the risks. But sadly, what I think is going to happen, someone who we all know, whether it's an athlete or an actress or a politician or someone, is going to get gastroparesis and have a really serious time with that and hopefully will not die. But that is going to change everything. When you start to hear about famous people dying from Ozempic, you're going to see a change in the warning label to warn very strenuously of gastroparesis, and then the usage is going to drop off. But I don't think that's going to happen, at least for another year or two. And it may not even occur until some of these cases percolate to trial, which is at least about 2 years away. So I anticipate an increase in these cases, an increase of the incidence of gastroparesis, and an increase in blindness until people wise up that this is a drug that isn't a catch-all for losing weight. I mean, what happened to portion control and exercise? There was an article I read, I think, in the New York Post that said 6 months ago, body positivity was all anyone talked about. Embrace how you look, the idea that you can live a healthy lifestyle and be morbidly obese. You can't say anything about anybody's weight. That's all out the window. You don't hear any about that anymore. All you see is pictures of very slim people and overweight people who embrace body positivity, now embracing their new slim look. It shows you just kind of how, I think, in the world of fashion and movie stars, hypocrisy is at its finest, because no one's into body positivity anymore. They're into losing weight the quickest and easiest way. And that's going to lead to more cases and more instances of serious complications and death.
So let's change gears here, because I know that you've been involved in the talc-based product litigation, and there's kind of a strategy that I wanted to ask you about. J&J is attempting a bankruptcy strategy, and I've heard it referred to as a Texas two-step. Can you explain what that strategy is and why you believe it may be a bad faith move by the company?
Oh, wait, this one really does scare me. The Texas two-step is a concept where a company who is not in financial distress. Many times they're multi-billion dollar companies, sometimes hundreds of billion dollars, $500 billion, have tons of money, well, very well funded. But they have a case, whether it's talcum powder and ovarian cancer, whether it's asbestos and mesothelioma. What the company does is break off and form a new company. They then transfer all of the liability for those cases to that new company and then completely unfund that company. So that company only has liabilities and has no assets. Then they take that company, which is really just recently created, and apply for bankruptcy protection. Now, that hardly has ever worked. It did work in asbestos, where you saw incredibly viable companies that were not in financial distress be able to put their asbestos claims into bankruptcy. And it changed how asbestos and mesothelioma cases worked forever since. What talcum powder is trying to do in J&J, they're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to say, we've got lots and lots of cases. We've got 10,000 cases that are filed against us and more every day. We don't want to deal with this. Let's declare bankruptcy. They started a new company. Let's declare bankruptcy, put it through the bankruptcy system, and these cases will get resolved quicker. And that's the only, probably the true part of it. And we don't have to deal with trials. We don't have to deal with punitive damages. We don't have to deal with bad press. That is a totally, that is taking the bankruptcy system and throwing it in the trash. Bankruptcy system is not there. So a company that is fiscally sound can create a new company that's unfiscally sound and transfer all their liabilities and go into BK. This is going to radically change how talc is handled. Now, me, I'm going to tell you this to be upfront. I have already resolved a vast number of my talc cases. They are resolved. I maybe have, you know, 20 or 30 cases that might be in jeopardy of falling under this. I did not think this was a good thing. I voted against the bankruptcy plan when they asked plaintiff's attorneys whether or not this plan should be approved, or at least it has the stamp of my approval. I said no. I would rather my cases be litigated. There are a lot of other attorneys, and I think those attorneys have a lot more invested in it, have been fighting this fight for a lot longer. Some of those, I think the firms themselves, were possibly in financial distress. They had to agree to this plan because they just need resolution. I personally did not vote for this, but I can see both sides of the apple here. But I think the problem with this is that if the bankruptcy court approves this filing by J&J, what is going to stop companies doing this every time they have a mass tort? If you can, for example, Ozempic, what would prohibit anyone from then saying, well, we're just going to transfer our Ozempic litigation to some made-up company, give it no assets, and declare bankruptcy? It would actually probably doom mass torts, because bankruptcy, you get paid about 10 cents on the dollar, if that. Who's going to get into mass torts? Who's going to get into representing individuals if you know you're going to go through bankruptcy? I don't know anybody. We're all going to have to do car accidents again. And I think that is what their plan is. Their plan is to incentivize plaintiff's attorneys from pursuing these cases, which means that they're going to be paying out less in claims, they're going to have less claims, and less people are going to be compensated by their injury. In the end, they don't really care about the patients. They're not trying to compensate people that were injured by their drugs. They're trying to find a way out of it to lessen the number of claims and also to pay them less. Do I think it's going to work in talc? I don't think it will. I mean, my gut feeling is that the bankruptcy court's going to see through this. They're going to see through it as a bad faith filing. They've tried it three times already. I think this is going to be enough. And I think the hopefully, if it even goes to the Supreme Court's going to say, this is just a bad practice. Bad faith is a word that's not thrown around lightly. They don't like to use that in bankruptcy, but I think certainly this is a prime example.
Well, it seems like it's an end run around corporate responsibility and consumer protection. I mean, if this kind of strategy is allowed, then as you said, you know, it seems like there's could be a very bleak future for the mass tort practice, but more importantly, you know, a shift away from being able to hold corporations responsible and protect consumers, which if that is the end result, that's a really horrific end result that could be, you know, using the bankruptcy laws to, you know, in a bastardized way to help corporations that don't need bankruptcy protection.
It would be awful. This one has always had me worried. I think what they're trying to do when they refiled this several times, they keep throwing more money, like a few more billion at it. It sounds like a lot of money, but it's not in the scope of the number of cases they're going to get in the future. They're just throwing more money. This is money that should have been thrown at these clients. This is money that should have been offered to these clients a long time ago. If they wanted to resolve these cases, they could. They had gotten hit with an incredible amount of bad press with some of the large verdicts that they were getting. They took talcum powder off the market. You know, you don't get talc anymore. You get, cornmeal is what you use. But there are new cases coming up every day. These new cases are certainly going to be in bankruptcy as soon as they're filed. And you're going to have to file them right in bankruptcy court, if you can believe it. It's going to de-incentivize these companies to put patient safety first. And they know bankruptcy is always the route they could take when there's a large number of claims. Like I said, the bastardization of the bankruptcy, that's a great way to describe it. That's exactly what's going on.
Another litigation that you've been heavily involved in is Roundup, and which is connected to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I know from conversations you and I had that they've refused to change the labeling to warn of the potential serious cancer risk from use. What's the current status of the Roundup-related lawsuits, and what challenges are you seeing develop in trying to secure justice for people in those cases?
Well, I always try to give full disclosure. Most of my Roundup cases I have resolved. They did go around a few years ago and just kind of own up and resolve most of the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cases that were out there. There are a few large firms that have a whole bunch, and there are firms that continue to try these cases. But the difference with this case is kind of like with talc. There are new cases coming up every day. Since they have not changed the label and refused to, if you look at Roundup, it does not say, do not use this or be warned, it could cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or other blood-related cancers. If they did that, that would stop litigation in its tracks from that day forward. Anyone that took that product after it has a warning on it can't come back and say, I want to sue over my non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They'll say it's on the bottle. You used it anyway. They refuse to do that. So what is happening with that is that my office continues to get calls from newly diagnosed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma patients that have used Roundup. That is a viable case that I could file today. It's a viable statute. It's still a good Roundup case in my mind. What has been happening? They have been dinged with huge verdicts all over the place. They fight them all through appeal. So I always make a joke, clients can't spend verdicts. Clients can only spend money. My bank does not accept verdicts. My bank only accepts money. So when people get verdicts, that's great, but they have to hold those verdicts. Meaning it has to go through the appeal process, and they'll appeal all the way up to the state court or even to the U.S. Supreme Court. What that does, it delays these cases, the payouts of these cases, for years. During that time, this is a cancer patient. They may pass away, sadly, which I hate to say is probably the hope of the company. If they lose on appeal, they're going to drag it out all the way to every appellate avenue is exhausted. But if they win, they're back at square one. That case has to be tried again, and maybe or maybe not, now the plaintiff involved has passed away. What they're also trying to do is take the fact that there is no warning label, let's say in California, there's no warning label required by the FDA. They're trying to say that any lawsuits are what's known as preempted. There's a theory about preemption that if a drug has been approved by the FDA or if the Consumer Protection Board doesn't want to require a label warning cancer, that you can't sue, meaning it essentially has the stamp of the government on it. And that stamp of the government means a plaintiff's lawyer like myself cannot sue over an injured person. That, depending on the venue, depending on the court, that sometimes is favorably viewed, sometimes not. They're hoping that this case is probably going to go to the Supreme Court and that there's going to be a ruling on preemption, and Roundup is going to be cleared of all liability. Now, thankfully, most of my clients have already been paid. I do have new clients, though, and those clients want justice. There is no warning label. They all say the same things, that if they knew it would cause cancer, I would probably just maybe pull up those dandelions by hand or whatever. And from a personal point, my dad had a Roundup case. I had a Roundup case for my father. He died from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and my dad used to use Roundup all the time at the house. If you know me, and I think you know Jason, I'm an avid gardener. So was my mom. So was my dad. Grew up in New Jersey. Dad was always killing weeds with Roundup. And he died in 2010 from Roundup, and I pursued a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma case for him. Can't give you the details, but I was glad that I was able to seek justice for my father for that case. And thousands of other people have too. But the way they're doing it, by not changing the label, that's really a disingenuous way to handle things. If patient safety, if consumer safety was at the forefront of their decision-making, they would change the label, accept responsibility for the, or at least fight it out in the courts. A warning label does not mean that it caused a specific, just from cases. Just because you warn that it might cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a plaintiff still has to prove that their own non-Hodgkin's lymphoma was caused by Roundup. It's not a given. The warning label just doesn't give you, you just don't go right to the verdict stage. You still got to win. And people have other factors that cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, smoking and familial history and whatnot. But if they were really putting consumer safety at the forefront, they would change the label today. That would cut off any future litigation, but they're trying to do it the back end, just like kind of that bankruptcy. They're trying to do it through the courts, get the courts to say that it doesn't cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, where basically it's almost settled science that it does. All you have to do is get one of their experts, I hate to use the word that they're a quack, but they're paid shills to get up there and testify over and over again that it can't be shown. Those same people testify at every trial. They're going to say the same thing no matter what the circumstances are of the case. So I'm hopeful that you will see a change in the label to warn of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. That'll mean no more cases for me, but that'll be a much more safer America.
It seems like it's an example of putting profits before consumers, meaning if they wanted to put a warning on there, they could easily.
Yep.
But obviously that would impact the profits from this type of product, and maybe they've done the analysis.
Someone knows, Jason, certainly that is going to affect. You're not going to see that huge stand of Roundup at Home Depot anymore, at least not as prominently displayed. I walk around. I mean, I go down the other aisle if I see that Roundup stand. I don't want to be near it. And when I see the gentleman walking around in my neighborhood, in my community, with a large thing of pesticide on their back, spraying around, I always just think to myself, and I tell my wife when we're driving, I hope there's not Roundup in there. But what can you do?
Yeah. Well, and that, I guess that brings me to a question about these corporations, which is, you've got corporations like J&J, Bayer, massive companies that have incredibly deep pockets, resources that they can use to delay or limit settlements, bankruptcy, which we've talked about, or, you know, all kinds of different avenues at their disposal if they want to. So for you, as someone that's been, you know, part of the mass tort system for years and years and years, what are the strategies that are used on the plaintiff side to make sure that the victims are properly represented in these high-stake battles?
Well, I'll tell you, from the standpoint of a smaller practitioner, I have a small office. It's myself and one attorney. We have two paralegals. I actively advertise for the cases I want. I only take very good cases. I'm always looking for a diagnosis of, we talked about that signature illness, whether it's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or rhabdomyolysis or mesothelioma. Being a small office, I don't have any problem bringing in a larger firm to co-counsel with me on certain cases. If I have a case which looks like it may possibly be on a trial selection, what I mean by that is that it's part of a group that the court decides would be appropriate for further discovery, what we call case-specific discovery, and move on to possibly the trial stage or the expert stage, I have no problem bringing in another firm that's experienced in the litigation. It might be a little more well-funded. Maybe they got four attorneys that could help me on the case with. I do that at my own discretion. But in many of these cases, when there is an MDL, and some people don't know what an MDL is, but when you have an MDL, you have leadership, which is appointed by the court, and those individuals basically are tasked with carrying the heaviest loads, getting experts, doing discovery, taking depositions. reviewing millions and millions of documents. I think the important thing that a smaller firm like myself can do is we give personalized attention to our cases. You're going to speak to me or my attorney on your case, or my associate on your case. When you call, you're going to get a return call from myself or an attorney. That's not really going to happen at a lot of big firms. You're probably going to have a case manager who's a paralegal, probably very experienced. But in terms of getting answers and feeling that you're not just a number, a firm like myself is a good place to go. You're going to get the same representation at the big firms, and you may not know it. I might even bring in a big firm to assist me on certain matters, but you're always going to be able to speak with me. So what that does for me is that I'm allowed to have my small boutique office. I'm allowed to provide more intimate client care and intimate client interaction, make them feel special, which they are, but still have the backing and the funding of larger firms. I give a portion of my fee. That's called, you know, fee splitting, but it's through a co-counsel relationship. Helps me out. I feel comfortable that the cases are certainly going to progress as they should. And if there is additional funding needed from somewhere, I have it. But I'm able to maintain control of the case and keep my clients happy. And you see that more and more right now. What I am not, and there's no problem for folks being one of these cases, being one of these type of law firms, I'm not a law firm that advertises and sends the cases out to other law firms. For years and years and years, I was one of the firms that people would send all their work to. I didn't do much advertising at all. There are large advertisers out there that say, have you had mesothelioma? Have you had gastroparesis? Those firms have no intention of working up those cases at all. What I mean by working up, pursuing it, taking it to trial, doing case prep, all that stuff. What they're going to do is send it out to an expert, which my firm is on that list. These are firms that refer those cases to me. I give them what's known as a referral fee. So that happens less frequently now because the number of folks that are advertising and not working them have reduced. You see a lot of big firms that are really dominating the market in terms of getting cases, but I still get several referrals every week from attorneys all over the country and some of my longstanding referral relations on all the cases we've mentioned. So keeps me busy, also allows me to spend time with my two-year-old daughter and do a lot of other things that I think some of these attorneys and some of the larger firms can't do, simply because they're, like I said, they have so many cases, they're just relegated to numbers as opposed to names. I know all my clients' names. I probably even know their family and their dog's name. And I think that's a great fit for me and my personality too.
That brings up a good question, because you've been involved in a wide range of mass tort cases over your career. And it seems as though there's been a shift in the entire ecosystem, the way it operates, particularly because now you've got some private equity money that's gotten into the investment side of fueling the litigation on the plaintiff side. But you do have firms that advertise, and then you do have firms that actually litigate the mass tort cases. Because, you know, the listeners of this podcast are all fellow trial lawyers. If a trial lawyer is interested in being involved in mass tort litigation, what's the way to do it today? Is it more the advertising route to get started? Is it, you know, really litigating these cases and trying getting into leadership? And how does the impact of the investment side of it that's happening impact practitioners today?
Sure. And I used to encounter that all the time. I used to be very active in the American Association for Justice. I was the head of their several what we call litigation groups for a variety of drugs. And you'd always have some meetings, and you get a guy you've never seen before, never heard of before, but he's a big shot in his local city, and he gets great verdicts. That person would always stand up and would say, I want to be appointed to the trial team on this litigation. I get the best verdicts in my county, or et cetera, and so on. What I like to tell folks is there are great trial attorneys everywhere in every city. There really are. Going up to an MDL meeting, organizational meeting, and saying, I'm the best trial attorney, put me on the trial team, isn't going to get most people nowhere, because we have great attorneys in mass torts that have been trying mass torts for decades. You're not going to go into mass torts and just jump right onto trying a case. Everyone's going to expect you to put in your time, and that time usually is measured in years and also multiple litigations. Additionally, not all that many cases go to trial. If you look at 10,000 cases filed, then you might have 15 or 25 trials. Look at the likelihood that your case is actually going to go to trial is very small. But you can bring other things to the table. Are you willing to do depositions? Are you willing to look for experts? Are you willing to just be a team player and maybe review documents? If you want to get into mass torts, at least get into some type of leadership, which means you don't have to necessarily be on a PSC, but you can be on various committees. Show your skills and put your time in. But everyone wants to just jump right in and try the case and do the opening statement. That's not going to happen in my mind. If you look at the composition of plaintiff steering committees and leadership for the past 20 years, I don't want to say it's remained static. Every once in a while you see some new names in there. But it certainly is the usual suspects of individuals, especially lead counsel, liaison counsel, et cetera. I could probably, if there's going to be 15 people on any given PSC, I could probably pick 10 of them off my head and they'll be on there. I just know who's going to apply and I know likely who's going to be appointed. For good and bad, a lot of those lead counsels just do an awesome job. It's kind of hard to say that, you know, some of the big players, Chris Seeger, Brian Alstock, and others shouldn't be lead counsel. They're doing such great jobs on litigations. It's well worth it to have individuals of that experience level to be in lead counsel. But being on a PSC is a little different. PSC, there are other things you could bring to the table other than trial skills. But if you want to be in mass torts and get on leadership, running to make an application to be on the PSC might not be the route to do it. I think going to organizational meetings and volunteering for being on several committees is the best way to do it. But more importantly, you don't get to that step without having the cases. I mean, I don't think a lot of folks, especially on committee stages, want to be involved solely for billable hours on an MDL. You only want to do it if you have like scratch in the game, you know, either by money or by cases. And back in the day, I'll use an example with Bakehall. I got my Bakehall clients by running an ad in a newspaper. I mean, that just sounds so backwards now. You run an ad in a newspaper. But my partner at the time, we would take out an ad in a large paper in a large U.S. New Jersey City, Newark or something, or in Middlesex County where I was living, and you'd run an ad, did you take Bakehall and suffer rhabdomyolysis? No one would do that anymore. I mean, trust me, no one's going to do that and expect to get any number of cases or any return on their investment. Now, there are true marketing experts. People use Facebook now. People use Google. You still see a lot of television ads. I don't see as many ads as much for mass torts. I see, mesothelioma probably is the exception. I do see some for Ozempic. But I think online marketing, social media marketing is how most folks are doing things. What has changed, and you mentioned this before, is that over the last several years, we began to see VC money coming in here, venture capital money, Wall Street money, has been interjected into the case acquisition process here for mass torts. That is a game changer. Lawyers, mass tort attorneys, do very well, but they don't have the millions upon millions upon millions that Wall Street has. And if Wall Street starts lending out money to acquire cases to certain firms, it's all likelihood that those certain firms are going to get the vast majority of cases and make other firms disinterested in spending similar money to try to get less cases. Because once someone gets involved and starts buying up ad times, that ad time becomes more expensive or starts dominating Facebook or social media advertising. That does worry me. Because the people that get into those types of arrangements, these cases take a long time to resolve. One of the things about mass torts, it could be 5-6 years before a case resolves. And what I mean by resolves is actually someone gets a settlement check. You know, when I talk about money, nothing pisses my clients off more than finding out a case settled, specifically their case, and waiting a year, year and a half to get paid because of lien resolution or some other things. Master settlement agreement has to get written up. These cases do take a long time. And when firms borrow money, meaning until they pay that money back, that money continues to accrue interest. And many times it's at an incredible interest rate. So I think there's going to be a way where VC money is going to come in. And there's already been some fallout from this. What you see right now is, some, or at least defense counsel, pushes judges in MDL settings to try to make plaintiff's counsel admit if they're getting funded by VC money or any funding, whether it's any bank or something like that. There's a large number of banks that specialize in lending out money. But they want that to be disclosed. I don't think that's proper, those disclosures at all. But they want to know who they're dealing with. I guess they want to know if someone, it's a double-edged sword when you borrow money. You got to pay it back at a huge interest rate. But they do know that you're very well funded. So I think they look at it on a case-by-case basis if funding in a particular plaintiff's counsel is either beneficial to the defense or not. The other thing that I think has happened is that I don't want to name names, but you could look up and do some Google searches. There are some firms that are in true financial distress because they have borrowed money on cases, specifically talc, that has been dragging on way too long. And the interest rate on those original loans to advertise have gotten so astronomical that even some of those firms have declared bankruptcy. And these are very well-known firms that represented many, many high-profile cases in terms of verdicts and had thousands of cases, were always known as leaders, and now are suffering the financial fallout of cases just taking too long on borrowed money. And I'm not a big one on borrowing any money. I like buying things in cash because interest sucks, but interest when it's 18% and it turns over every year, that really is scary. And I think that's that double-edged sword that we're going to see what happens. And that is branching out outside of mass torts too. You see it in intellectual property and other things. I subscribe to it's an online, every day you get updates on mass torts or whatever you want. It's called Law 360. I'm always reading about some firm that's in financial distress from VC or reading about some court that's requiring individuals to disclose their associations with VC. Like I said, I don't think it's proper, but it's certainly become on the forefront. And I think this year it's really going to come to a head. We're going to figure out very soon whether or not any of those disclosures should be mandatory. And I think you may see, depending on how talcum powder goes, you may see some firms in the future begin to disclose that they are in financial distress simply because talcum powder is taking too long.
So I wanted to end on a couple of little questions about your practice, because you talked a little bit about it, that you've got a boutique small practice, but it's quite unique in the way that you've structured it. Can you talk about how you've built it into a virtual type practice?
Well, when I say it's funny, my office has been virtual since 2011. We have no physical office. Everyone works from home. Everything is electronic. That worked great for us for one reason. Since I do mass torts and I represent individuals from all over the country, I rarely have to meet my clients. We communicate by phone, predominantly by email, depending on, some elderly people prefer the phone method, but mail, but email is great. I don't meet them. Sometimes I'll Zoom with them. But if you make your clients feel important by telephone interaction, the need to have an in-person meeting just kind of dissipates. This is not a car accident where there's a local guy comes in my office. He wants to meet me. He wants to see how I'm dressed. They might come by every week, those clients. I know individuals that do those type of work, that type of work, meet their clients frequently. I didn't have to do that and never have. So having my virtual office worked great. A couple of things, little rubs in there. I think John Morgan said something, hire slowly, fire quickly. When you hire someone in a virtual setting, you do find out very quickly whether or not they can handle it. I'm not saying they're not great lawyers or great paralegals, but some people just don't have it in them to be properly motivated and properly disciplined to work in a virtual environment. They're watching ESPN or they're playing basketball or whatever they're doing. It's not doing their work. I find that out very quickly as to whether or not someone can handle it. But my employees that I have been with me for years. You know, my associate for 6 years. We are all perfectly suited for whatever reason, whether it's our personality or our home life, that a virtual office environment works very well. I can't say that's going to work for everybody. And as you know, right now, there is an emphasis of trying to get everyone back in America, back to work, back to the office. My wife works in the financial services industry, and they're actively trying to get everyone back to the office 5 days a week, and they're getting a lot of pushback. But back to my particular office. One of the benefits of being virtual since 2011 is that we didn't miss a beat when COVID came. When I think it was March of 2020, when my wife, I think it was St. Patrick's Day, believe it or not, just a few days ago, she called me and said, "They're sending me home." And I said, "Sending me home?" And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" She said, "Ah, it might be a couple weeks." Well, Rachel was home for 2 years working from home. What that happened to a lot of law firms is that it totally threw them into disarray. Suddenly, you have to close down your office, especially if you were in states like California or other places where they really locked you down. Suddenly, you have to get computers, you have to get this. And then, as I mentioned, where you find out quickly if someone can't work from home, you might have had a great paralegal or a great attorney in an office setting. And overnight, you transferred them to home, and you found out that just wasn't their forte. So you saw a lot of attrition. I think you saw a lot of instances where people didn't get the service that they were expecting. I think a lot of cases really were neglected by some firms. You could see that just on the various dockets. And it took years to get back to even trying cases. My firm just was, we didn't miss a step. The only thing that was probably problematic for my firm is that we then had to suffer along with the other firms where the court system shut down. Other firms, the defense firms, would use COVID as the excuse for just about anything. Anything they didn't want to do, answer interrogatory, provide documents. COVID was the excuse. We're working from home. And I used to tell the judge, "Hey, man, I'm working from home and I can do it. Well, you know, what's the problem? I mean, I'm a small firm. You're a big firm." That never went anywhere. Nowadays, believe it or not, you still hear about COVID throwing off a trial where I don't know who tests for COVID anymore, but it seems like defense counsels are keeping the COVID testing business in business because they always seem to want to test before a trial day. And if they can throw that COVID positive around to a judge, they're probably going to get an adjournment. I'm talking about they'll test 2 days before a trial that they don't want to do. And just by luck, maybe if they're COVID positive, that's something they're going to use to try to, put that trial date off. That does happen, if you could believe it. And it happens more frequently than anyone would like to admit. But I think that's kind of not happening as much anymore. But in my firm, we didn't have to also, one of the things about being virtual, no one had to quarantine. You know, we didn't have to worry about, we didn't have to be in a pod. And it really, I did a big smile on my face where we had a seamless transition at the lockdown orders. It's nothing changed at my firm at all, unlike so many others. But I'm happy it's over. I'm happy everyone is, we're no longer subject to any of those lockdowns and COVID is basically passed. But we're prepared for any eventuality here at the Michael Brady Lynch Firm, that's for sure.
Well, you've been very generous with your time today. Last question, something sure. I always ask, and completely open-ended, so you can answer it however you want, whatever you want to talk about. And it's, what's your view as a mass tort trial lawyer?
With all my years of experience now, I really have found you can still do a lot of good as a mass tort attorney. And you could do a lot of good as a mass tort attorney, not having to run out and try cases and subject your clients to that. It's funny, when I have deep conversations with my clients about how they'd like me to proceed with this case, almost all of them start off saying, "Well, I want to go to trial. I want to hold someone accountable, et cetera, and so on." When I explain to them, sometimes it takes one or two conversations about what that means. And sometimes I just have to do a hypothetical. Let's say we could get your case to trial. Let's say we could do this. Are you prepared for 4 or 5 weeks in Pensacola, Florida? Are you prepared to have your whole family testify, prepared to have your whole family give depositions? All those things, it sounds less and less attractive to my clients. Do they want to go that route other than trusting my judgment and saying, "Let's go through this case. Let's get you the best number we can. Let's make sure that your number is objectively exactly what you should get vis-a-vis your injuries." In the end, it's about doing the best for your clients, not only in money, but also making sure that this does not detrimentally affect their lives any more than their lives have already been affected by it. It's not just about verdicts. It's about getting them adequate compensation, making them feel good about being represented by attorney, trying to dispel this notion that we're only in it for the money, to show them the best proper service. And that is what my small firm really does. And I'm going to continue doing mass torts until it's no longer feasible for my office. And I think the way things are changing, we're always able to adapt and continue to be active in it and active and get the best clients I want and the best cases I want. I'm going to continue to do that because I think I do a great job with making the clients feel special.
Well, if any of our listeners are interested in sending a case to you or want to consult with you about a particular mass tort matter, what's the best way to get in contact with you?
Best way to contact is just to give the office a call or go on my website, MBL Lynch Firm. Just contact, you know, just hit the contact here button. Someone will call you back within an hour, no later. I monitor, just like everybody, probably like you, Jason, I'm on my phone almost the whole time. Even though I work from home, this computer is always on and my phone is always on. Anyone who wants to even just talk about a case for potential referrals, that's always something that I'm happy to do for anyone to guide them on the right track of what cases I'm looking for. And if you're going to advertise, not to spend your advertising dollars on cases that won't end up being cases, whether it's statute problems or the injury is not appropriate.
Michael, thanks for being on the podcast today. And we'll see everybody on the next episode of Trial Lawyer View.
Hey, Jason, it was a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
Here is another episode of Trial Lawyer View. We hope you enjoy today's guest and discussion. Tune in to our next episode for more helpful insights from fellow trial lawyers and practice experts. This podcast is brought to you by Synergy. Visit partnerwithsynergy.com to learn more about how Synergy can free your firm to focus on what it does best.